This is continuing with Hewish on 19th August 76. Minkowski gave a talk there which may have impressed you.
Oh, indeed, yes, indeed.
About that.
Yeah, that was when that was, of course, the first the optical identifications were known before that, weren't they? That was 52. Okay.
Right, 51.
51, but that was the first time he came out, I think, and we really saw him, you know. But no, I think it was, what I was about to say was, I think it was then, on that actual journey, that we really decided that what we should be building was a four-element interferometer, the thing from which 3C actually finally derived. But it was actually not going to be a... we changed the design...
4C.
No, I don't mean 4C. I mean 3C. I mean 2C had only just... Well, 3C hadn't happened then, had it?
3C had not yet begun, but it's always been my understanding that there was always planned to do two frequencies with the same... Same aerial.
Two frequencies?
Yes.
Ah, I'm not talking about two frequencies. No, I mean, to my recollection, the surveys that have been going on up to then had been done with the with extensions of the long Michelson array.
Right.
Right? And that was essentially that was the 1C era. The 2C survey was made by John Shakeshaft and others with a four-element interferometer.
Right.
Now that was the brainchild that we more or less dreamed up on that trip, except that we were not going to...
But no, hold it. That was published in 55, the 2C, the same year as the Dublin...
2C, but I'm not talking about 2C. I'm talking about what's coming is 3C.
Okay.
Just a minute. My memory's getting bad, isn't it?
The Dublin thing was 58.
It was 55.
And 2C was published in 55, therefore observed that
2C was published
two or three years before then.
Well, then maybe, yeah. There must have been some other meeting we went to.
Where you came back in
the room. Over this thing. Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
some other meeting.
There must have been some other meeting. When we started to build an antenna, and in fact never completed it, because the idea was to have an interferometer pair like this, and then an interferometer pair like that.
Two diagonals,
and compare those interference patterns to get accurate declination. But in the end, we built all four, and the other one never got built. I mean, we started to hammer iron into the ground, but never completed it because this other idea of having actual four overtook it. So that must have been a long time. I mean, that was the first 2C thing, so that this discussion must have been some other meeting. I'm thinking.
What was the other idea?
Just to use antennas in pairs. I think a pair like that. And then in a pair like that, you see, use crossed interferometers like that. Whereas in fact, in the end, as you know, we connected them up like this, and did all four at the same time. It was a different, and this was to have been a much simpler device than this finally turned out to be. Yes, you're quite right. That thing had all been going to see we're going for a long time. Yeah.
Any other recollections from the Jodl Symposium?
That was also a recollection of a Russian theorist whose name escapes me, who was quite impressive. He never came out again.
Talking about synchrotron?
Talking about, no. Well, he may have been, yes, but it wasn't the guy that invented synchrotron.
So to speak.
No. No, I mean, it's a long way back, that meeting now, but I remember it as being a lively sort of meeting where things, people hopped up and down, and it mattered what people said, and... you were annoyed when people, you know, contradicted you.
I've heard someone say that Martin Ryle got up with a long strip chart of the 2C survey, I think it was this meeting, and someone else assisted him and held it up on the stage, and the audience was just, once again, sort of
in awe of all these sources.
Of all the sources coming out. That could well be, because, yeah, that's right, there were sources everywhere. I mean, that survey was badly confusion limited. There were sources everywhere on the record.
But
that's
the point,
right.
That
rings a sort of bell.
It was still an exciting point in this meeting.
Oh yeah. Oh yes.
Things were happening.
Yeah. Surely.
Let's see. Next thing I have here in terms of publications is the Crabb solar corona occultations in June '56, and then I guess you were doing them virtually every year.
Oh yeah. More or less.
Consistently improving things.
Mm,
and what were you finding out as you went through the '50s?
Well, the thing was to extend it to as far away from the sun as possible, try and get the coronal density distribution, and then finally to to measure the scattering in three different directions, essentially using a triangulated interferometer system, to see if one could get scattering anisotropies, which would tell you something about the filamentary structure of the corona. I mean, one had seen little coronal filaments close to the pole, and the idea was that if these things extended further out, you could see which direction the filaments were in. And nobody had any ideas then about the solar magnetic field, I mean, any distance from the sun.
Right.
But we all knew elementary plasma physics and knew that the field would influence the plasma, and you'd get the frozen-in configuration.
Right.
And I remember looking particularly for a dipole field, in the sense that, I mean, everybody knew the sun had a north and south pole, and it was thought that the dipole field lines would be going like that, so that if you had filaments lined up parallel to these things, you ought to get scattering which was preferentially roughly right angles to the magnetic field. And the idea was to look with triangulated interferometers to see if these things actually happened. And the first surprise was that the field lines never bent back. I mean, they went out straight, you know.
Mm. Now, about this time, there were intimations of a solar wind. I mean, Biermann and others were talking about the comet tails might...
Yeah, that's right.
Were you tied in with this?
Yes, a bit. Yeah. It was consistent, and... there's a paper published before the solar wind really was a term in use,
right,
where we suggested that the flow, in fact, that the field lines we were getting suggested the flow, there might have been a flow like that. This was a paper I wrote, it was a monthly notices paper with probably Windham or something.
Well, I don't seem to, before 1960?
Oh, yeah.
Well, hold it now. It may not have made this radio astronomy bibliography, because it was deemed to be more space physics or something.
No, I'm pretty sure it was before 1960.
Well, actually, I have a list of the ones afterwards. No, here you are. Hewish and Windham, 63, Solar Corona in Interplanetary Space.
That's probably it.
That's the one.
That may well be it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that may well be it.
Yeah, I just have a list of the ones after 60. I didn't have the answer.
We specifically mentioned our outflow then.
Right.
Certainly.
But by that time, there were spacecraft observations, Mariner 2 and
such.
Right.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. But what about back in the mid-50s? I mean, Biermann's, I think, ideas came up in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the thing to do is to try and find the first published paper with I can't remember so far back, actually.
Okay.
Because I know I've got some papers somewhere about the field. There was a paper I published here. Well, now there's this sort of thing where you publish the actual direction which the scattering went. There were papers prior to this. There was a paper I published with Gorgonevsky.
That's right. That was Observatory, 1960.
Yeah.
Crab, once again, another occultation.
Yeah.
So you think it's fair to say that this these observations did not really contribute to the idea of a solar wind?
They certainly contributed to it, I think, because there was evidence of density far from the sun. I mean, it couldn't have been dropping off like after -6 or something, which one observed close
right.
in.
That's
and it was, after all, the only way of looking at the solar plasma out there, other than very rare total eclipses. And Parker was very glad that we were getting stuff. I mean, he used our data as corroborative evidence that you know, there was something a long way from the sun.
Right.
But we weren't specifically talking about winds. I mean, we're just trying to get the density variation, I think.
Were you able to measure a velocity in any sense? I mean...
Oh, later, but not then.
But not in the 50s?
No, not in the 50s. This came when we had this, you know, when the interplanetary scintillation came out.
Right.
But certainly not in the early days.
Let's see. Anything else here before 60? That looks like it, at least from your publications. You were not directly involved with the whole 2C controversy. Well, let me ask then about the next big thing, really, was the early 60s, when you came up with interplanetary simulations. Mm-hmm. Had you thought about this as a possibility before, or was it a matter of...
Yes, rather. This is the actual date on the notebook mentioned in the Nobel lecture. But the possibility of scintillation, we thought about years before. I'll have to look back and see just what date it was, but it was early in the occultation. I mean, when I was on the atmospheric scintillation stuff, extending it to the solar corona. The immediate question was, why don't you see, why is it just broadened? Why don't you see actual fluctuations in the signal? Because, that's what ionospheric scintillation is. You don't see the source jiggling about in the sky. Well, you do, but you see intensity fluctuations. And I remember we did calculations and came up with the notion that these things, the fluctuations, would be about 1 kilohertz in speed, mm-hmm. in temporal rate, and but to see them at all, you'd need a source with a ridiculously small angular size, seconds of arc or something.
Because the screen was so far away?
Because the scattering was so great. No one had ever done an extrapolation and said, if you look 10 times further from the sun, and there really are sources 100 times smaller than we know about, then this thing could be detectable. I mean, no one ever thought of being such a mad fool as to look for it. And I've been kicking myself solidly ever since, because it would have shown up quasars years before they happened if anybody had actually bothered to do that experiment.
And technically it could have been done in the early 50s or something.
Really?
How was it that you finally did come upon the interplanetary simulations?
That was quite straightforward. We'd been doing a survey of accurate positions, looking at certain sources over and over again, using the, what antenna would we have been using then? This would have been done at Northbridge, so this would have been done on the 4C antenna, but not using synthesis. This was work done by Margaret Clark and others, where certain sources were being looked at day after day to get the position more accurately for identification. And one or two of these sources showed peculiar fringe patterns, where the fringes were slightly unequal in size, and persistently on some sources. And Margaret Clark, in her thesis, noted that these things were not so very far away from the sun, in the sense of within 30 degrees elongation, something mm-hmm. like that. And the idea of scintillation came up in a discussion one Saturday morning. We always come back to these Saturday mornings. We were all talking around these things. And somebody said something about ionospheric scintillation, you see. And it was around about then that the Henry Palmer was getting the angular diameters of these sources and showing that they were less than a few seconds of arc or something. And someone said, well, why isn't it like ionospheric scintillation? And I went over the numbers again in my head, and the penny dropped, flashed, it could happen. Mm-hmm. At first I thought, well, it's crazy, it can't, because I already remembered the earlier argument, you see, but when thinking about it again. And so we did specific experiments on 3C48, which was then the one which was known to be about 2 seconds of arc or something.
Right.
And lo and behold, there it was. The thing was fluctuating. So that's how that happened.
So what you're saying is that these earlier calculations on the solar corona had sort of given you a mental block, more or less.
There was 100 times, you need a source 100 times smaller than any then known. That's right. One had just forgotten about it, put it to one side.
Right. I forgot to ask Martin Ryle about it, but I won't forget to ask you, namely about the Sputnik. I've heard that this was on a Friday, October 4th, and that, can you tell me what happened on the Saturday, one of these Saturday morning sessions?
We said something about why the devil don't we build a simple interferometer to look at it. And I wasn't actually involved with the building of it, but a couple of guys went out, Bruce Elsmore, I think, somebody else, and lashed up a couple of dipoles. And just strung them out on the ground virtually at the rifle range, which is not far from here, and got the fringes. And then, of course, the balloon went up. This thing was in transit, and we knew where it was pretty accurately. And Jodrell Bank was able to get onto it and track it, but until then hadn't been able to pick it up because, one didn't know the position of the thing.
Right. Were you part of the group that was working rather feverishly on this for a couple of weeks?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Everybody did, I think. Yeah. Everybody did. Mm. There wasn't much to do once it had happened, you went up there and listened to the thing going bleep, bleep, bleep. But I think everybody dropped tools then. Yeah. I think I wasn't so excited as some other people about it, I don't think, at the time, actually.
Now, I'm cutting things off in general in my study in the early 60s, so I won't ask about further details of your ionospheric work, but there are a couple exceptions I'm going to make. And one of those is certainly the pulsar business. I understand that this fellow Woolgar has interviewed you. Is that correct for his thing? So I won't belabor the point because he'll be publishing that. But I still would be interested if you could tell me basically how this came about from your point of view.
Well, we couldn't have missed them. I mean, we were doing a sky survey. Which bit you're actually interested in? I mean, there's no point going right back. You've read all this junk, haven't you? The point was, I was interested in doing a sky survey of scintillating sources just to get angular sizes, and built the 4-acre array to do it. And we just were plotting every source that showed a fluctuation, wherever it occurred. And there wasn't long before Jocelyn Bell, who was working on the project, had caught them. Mm. You know, I mean, the project was to analyze the records, continuous records. I got plenty to show you. And just write down everything that fluctuated.
I see.
It wasn't a question of analyzing and sort of to pick off the interesting things. We put down literally every fluctuation because we knew that there was going to be a lot of interference. There was a lot of electrical interference. And I think personally what showed them up fairly quickly was a chart we plotted where the idea was to put on a crude sky chart. This was something I asked Jocelyn to do. Put crosses wherever a source happened, you know, in RA and DEC. Now, we were making repeated surveys every week. The sky was looked at again for the scintillation survey. And if crosses kept on inking themselves in, they were genuine. If they just occurred randomly, then it was just sporadic interference.
Right.
And this one had happened about twice, what Jocelyn noticed was that, she was analysing the whole record, but normally you don't get much going on during hours of darkness when you get ionospheric scintillation, which causes these things, but when there isn't ionospheric scintillation, you don't get much interplanetary scintillation, because it's around the backside of the sun, where to a pretty low level.
Right, right.
And she brought it to me and said, look, isn't it funny that we're getting this interplanetary scintillation around the back?
Even at night.
Yeah.
And was the idea of doing it every week to new sources?
No, it was a technique. You want to watch sources. You want to watch sources as they vary the solar elongation.
Right.
That's the way we actually measure diameters.
Right.
So to fill in enough elongations, you have to plot it every week.
Paul Scott made the interesting comment to me. I'd be interested if you agree or not that the four original pulsars were sort of the only ones that could be found. They had the right dispersion intensity and so forth.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much so, actually. We found some more later. I mean, the number from here went up to about six, finally.
But it was rather discouraging that you were expecting really to come up with quite a bit more.
Well, not terribly, were we? I wasn't very discouraged, actually. I mean, for a long time, we had six, and that score wasn't beaten for a year or two. You know, when the big telescopes turned on it, they didn't turn up pulsars very quickly.
No,
they didn't. No, I mean, if you look back in the literature, I think our six... I mean, at the end of the first 2 years, there was something like 20 or something, we discovered more than a third of the whole shoot. Arecibo didn't get them for a long time. Jodrell Bank got a few. They got a few, but I mean, the numbers were very low for the first few years.
Right.
And so we realized this dispersion business that the antenna wasn't really well suited for pulsar work. It was very well suited to make the initial discovery. I mean, it couldn't have failed.
Yeah.
To have discovered pulsars, however we'd analyzed the records, whoever was on the job. I mean, you know, if it would have been gross negligence not to have seen them, because, I mean, they were the biggest scintillating sources in the sky sometimes. We were onto them quickly, because the record analysis was being done pretty smartly, and, I mean, that was good, you know.
Right.
I'm pleased that we did, but if we hadn't got them, my God, we shouldn't have been doing radio astronomy.
Yeah.
It was just a great good fortune to be in that
And what happened is that once you had these strongly scintillating sources, you began looking at them, and then it became pretty clear that there was a periodicity in it.
Well, it wasn't clear for a long time, though.
No.
Well, you can read all this history, it's all written down, but we didn't believe it was a genuine signal till after 6 months after we were seeing it. And getting pulses made us disbelieve it even more.
You didn't believe the scintillating signal either, even before you
knew thought that
pulses.
It was a... No, I mean... we started picking these things up, you see,
yeah.
And initially we thought, well, it could be a source of very small diameter scintillating very strongly around the antisolar direction, but since the record looked a bit funny and was jittering in time, incidentally, the transit time of this thing can shift by up to one or two minutes, we thought that it was somebody mucking about, you know. We didn't think it was a proper signal until it had reappeared about six times, which was... first time it ever appeared on a record was the middle of July, and that record was being analysed in August sometime. So it was, in fact, September-ish when we began to get really suspicious about this thing.
Why did the time of transit change by a minute or two?
Why? Because the source switches on or off, and we got a broad beam, and so you sometimes see it...
Oh, I see. So it was really more time of detection, which you were taking to be time of transit or something like that.
Yeah, that's
right. That would be very confusing indeed.
Well, it was confusing. And it was for these reasons it looked wrong. I mean, you know, we knew what scintillating sources looked like.
Yeah.
And this looked
a
bit funny because the beam was too narrow and sometimes, and as I was saying, it shifted because of that, you see.
Right.
So we set up a... We were doing experiments. I was concerned with scintillation theory and getting as rapid a recording as possible. And we got a special system set up in September using a new fast recorder for looking at 3C273, which makes a close transit past the sun then. And I wanted to test out scintillation theory. And we had this thing set up. And I asked Jocelyn to hook it on so that we actually looked at the strange thing as well to see what character the signals actually had. Because if it was interference, you know, they wouldn't look like scintillation, they'd look like something else. And nothing happened until November the 28th, because, the special experiment had priority on 3C273. And when that was finished, that was coming on to October. And Jocelyn then ran the thing for several days, looking at CP1919, as it was later called, but nothing happened. She didn't get anything. She was getting a bit fed up, when all of a sudden it came back, and that's when she bought the first pulses.
So it didn't really have that high a priority during those first
few months. No. I mean, the survey just went on. Well, I mean, the point is, there wasn't much to do about it. If it was real, it would keep repeating itself. And I thought it was a flare star, actually, in September, because we could just about have detected... Stars like the sun, a bit more violent, we could have detected with this telescope. And solar activity, we all knew about, and it looked a bit like that, you know, a fluctuating signal.
Yeah.
So I thought probably we detected that. And some of those calculations actually came out in the first publication, that if it was a flare type, you know, something like a solar flare, could have been detectable at the distances of nearby stars.
Right. Well, one final thing that I'm interested in is the whole business of, you've got this completely different sort of signal that's been ever gotten in radio astronomy before, and you're obviously thinking now, what do we do with this, and thinking of the possibility that it was an intelligent signal and so forth. And someone has mentioned to me that there was real concern for a few weeks, well, should we be notifying the government and so forth?
We didn't know what it was, and if it could have been intelligence, we were a bit... I mean, You can't forget about the possibility of picking up intelligent signals.
Sure.
And this seemed to be the most likely origin for a while. The moment the accurate timing of the signals was known, then I realized we could do a Doppler shift experiment to actually get orbital motion, which would have been a good test for that. But talking about it with Martin Ryle, we said, you know, if it turns out that intelligence is the simplest explanation, what do we do with it? And we never really answered that question. But you can't just publish it as science. I mean, it isn't science. We thought we were going to have some sort of a... Well, it wasn't really a press conference. I mean, we were going to go down and talk to the Royal Society. That was really what was in our minds, that we would have people like Blackett and, you know, the scientific big guns, and put it to them. What do we do about this?
Right, a close
session. But keep it amongst top scientists to begin with.
Sort of black cloud, sort of...
In a sense. We didn't really quite know how to handle it. And we felt we had to talk to somebody. You know...
But why wasn't it science? I mean, it seems to me like it would be science. It would be perhaps the greatest scientific discovery of all time.
Well, no, I mean, it isn't. It's a message. I mean, it isn't astrophysics if somebody's signaling.
Well,
what I'm saying is you can't just publish a Nature letter saying, I have discovered intelligent signals from outer space.
Well, that's an interesting philosophical point, but I hadn't thought about that.
Well, I mean, it isn't. I mean, they're not natural signals.
Okay? Well, would you argue that all of the experiments that are beginning to be done now to look for extraterrestrial intelligence are not really science? It's some other activity of society.
Well, it's scientific in a sense, but it's not what I call science, no.
I never thought of that. I'll have to think about that some. But you must have, when you were thinking that it might be intelligent, looking for various sorts of modulation, is this right?
That's right.
And what sort of approaches did you take?
Well, just common sense ones. I mean, really, once you've got strings of pulses to look at, you look at them saying, are they telling me anything? There wasn't much sophisticated you could do because we couldn't break the pulse down. I mean, the sensitivity was only just enough to pick
up. Oh, I see. You couldn't break the pulse down. That's what I was thinking about.
These little... I mean, you get a chart running along with little blips like that on it, you know, most of the time. And you can only just detect these things in the noise.
So it was really just the amplitudes of the pulses and the...
That's right. Yeah, I mean, you looked at them and said, well, you know, is it going 3-3-1 or something like that?
Yeah.
And it wasn't doing anything logical. I mean, we did cross-correlation analyses on these records, which would have shown up any patterns in the
right.
pulses. And there wasn't anything there.
For this reason, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, then, and what was it that finally took you away from the idea of intelligence?
Intelligence, two things. First of all, that the doctorship showed there wasn't any. I mean, there's no orbital motion.
How long did it take to establish that?
Well, it took... We began timing on December the 11th, and it was just about New Year when we got enough data to actually plot these things out properly and show that there was a doctor shift, a big doctor shift, but it was all the Earth's orbital motion doing it, not the back. And when you'd corrected for that, there wasn't any residual, which
right.
could have been something else. And I reckon it took about 2 weeks to really know that answer.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, we'd come up with one or two more pulsars, actually. You know, suspicious-looking things, which looked as though they were pulsars.
Right.
And these were confirmed early in the new year. And, well, I mean, I don't know why it should be, but if you have two or three, it's less likely to be intelligence than if you've got one. I don't know the logic of that, but
yeah, I've thought about that myself. It's been said.
There is no... No, I mean, to my mind, it was the lack of any Doppler shift, and the fact that this thing, if it was in a planetary orbit, you know, it was in such a long period orbit that it wouldn't have been warm enough to support life. I mean, it couldn't have been near enough to any sensible star.
Yeah, or any sort of life that weren't... Mm. Once again, black cloud would not really be ruled out. I mean, did that
right.
bother you at all?
No. No, I mean, in fact, by about early New Year, I was perfectly happy that this was just some kind of a star, you know, compact
yeah.
star. We were looking at the White Dwarf story. And all
right,
something.
Right. Was this the discovery of the other pulsars a deliberate search to see
oh, yeah.
if there are more of these things?
Oh, sure,
yeah.
sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the moment we knew what to look for, we Jocelyn went coming back through all the records. And 0950, I remember, I'd spotted that one sometime earlier on, while we were wondering about CP1919, there's this thing. I'd seen a source on the record that looked awfully suspicious, and that turned out to be 0950. And Jocelyn found 1133 and some other one. Anyway, we looked up possible pulsars and did searches night after night, you know,
yeah.
to check them off. And some were and some weren't.
Okay, well, to close, do you have any comments about how you've seen radio astronomy grow over 25, 30 years almost?
Oh, well, I mean, it's settled down now to a steady branch of astronomy,
yeah.
I think. I mean, what I've seen is the heat go out of it, I think. I mean, the 60s were a sort of golden age when everything was happening. I mean...
You think that even more so than the 40s or 50s?
Oh, yes. I mean, well, the 40s and 50s were enormous fun. They were tremendous. I mean, when the first redshifts came in, you know, the discovery of Cygnus
right.
and so forth. I mean, that was a marvelous period. But we were still talking about colliding galaxies then. I mean, right up almost in 1960, people were talking about colliding galaxies, and we didn't really know what was going on. And I don't think we were proper astrophysicists in any sense then.
Mm-hmm.
But the 60s, I think, were the golden age when, you know, the quasars really raised their heads.
Right.
When molecular lines came after that. But then there was the background radiation.
Right.
And pulsars.
Right.
You know, and those... One couldn't really have kept that sort of excitement up. And I think the late 60s and merging into the 70s and now almost into the 80s, you know, the things sort of leveled off. And it's steady, systematic work on all these different things that's going on. And when you come to a conference, people aren't jumping up and trying to turn the world upside down like they were in the early days.
Oh, yeah. I've heard people, most people that were working in the late 40s say that was an extremely exciting time.
Oh, well, yes, it was.
Every time you build a new aerial, you
think,
discoveries.
Oh, sure, yeah, that's right, yes, yes.
But are you arguing that the 40s were that way, and the 50s not quite so much, and
well,
the 60s really took
the
off?
I mean, there were sort of two phases. I mean, first of all was the wild surmise, you know, that the sky was full of these peculiar objects, which were at large redshifts, and nobody knew what they were. I mean, you know, Cygnus-type objects. But in the and the phase then was to build bigger telescopes, get better positions, and just really count them. There was all the excitement about cosmology and the first source
right.
counts. I mean, that was terribly exciting when the first source counts showed this wild divergence.
You said a wild surmise about the fact that most of these sources are extragalactic. What do you
mean? Oh, no, I'm sorry, no. I mean, the first telescopes were showing radio sources everywhere, and nobody knew what they were. And there were just one or a handful of identifications. And we were just, I mean, the
the push in radio astronomy was to make bigger telescopes, more sensitive telescopes, mm. and get many more of them, yeah. and get better positions. So there was no doubt what anybody ought to be doing.
I see.
And it was just simply that.
And it was a bit more of a drudgery sort of thing, are you saying?
When?
In the 50s. I mean, that you just had to continue doing the same thing, only to try to do it better.
No. Well, I mean, the 50s was a sort of, in a sense, consolidation. I mean, really establishing what some of these things were, these radio sources, careful position measurements that led to the discovery of signals, and then the first systematic surveys, the cosmological possibilities. I mean, the cosmological thing was of course a tremendous excitement
right.
when
right.
we realized that source counts could tell you something about cosmology. But there was then the phase when it was realized that you had to have really rather more sophisticated techniques. And synthesis came along, and that took, you know, time to get operational. But then, with the synthesis on the one hand, showing you all these wonderful double objects, and the long baseline interferometry showing you some of these highly compact objects, the first discoveries of the first quasars, and then the other things like the microwave background and pulsars and so on, that was a sort of second great boost of excitement.
Right.
I mean, really, it was exciting all the time.
But I see what you're saying, yeah.
But what I'm saying, it sort of goes in waves, and I mean, and looking back to the mid-50s, I mean, it was all tremendously exciting then. But on a much more, in a sense, sort of amateurish level. Hello?
So you
say... I mean, it's settled down now, and people are yeah. doing steady, systematic spade work. And you can't expect it to be like it was.
Right. But are you sort of waiting that any year now is sort of inevitable that... it seems to me, for instance, the resolution of what's going on with the quasars. For instance, maybe it'll become established that there are non-gravitational redshifts or something like this really could bust open physics.
Yeah, I don't expect that. I take a fairly conventional view. It seems to me that there's no reason to throw physics overboard. Okay, there are high-energy sources, but, I mean, there are lots of galaxies now that require high energy. The quasars aren't special in that respect as the infrared galaxies and so forth. No, I think physics is going to be all right. I mean, I doubt if they're all black holes. Even if they were, it wouldn't bust open physics, I don't think. I mean,
yeah.
I understand physics of black holes is getting along quite nicely, isn't it? But we're not going to... The instruments have more or less reached the end. I mean, I think there are not many avenues of pure investigation that are going to show up wildly new phenomena. We know how big the quasar sources actually are. We know something about the motions of them, these highly compact objects. Things like the VLA are not going to show up things we don't know about.
Well, that's a very controversial statement, I would
think. Why would you say that? I mean, one knows what angular structure more or less exists in radio sources, and one knows what resolution it's going to give, and I think I can't see where we're going to turn up funny things. I mean, it isn't a highly sensitive instrument, it's an instrument for high resolution. And one knows now, more or less, what structure is left to be resolved, and there isn't very much. I mean, it'll have a comparable resolution to the point that 3 arcseconds you can push ours to at 15 gigahertz.
Yeah.
And there's not really going to be an awful lot.
You don't think that, for instance, many detailed maps of the very inner nuclei of galaxies might resolve the problem of what powers galactic nuclei, something like this?
Oh yes. But I mean, this is... what I'm saying is that we know roughly how big these objects are already, and we're producing maps of them just like the early radio maps, and showing that they're little complicated things.
Yeah.
It's going to be... The rate at which one can actually produce information of this sort is so slow that I don't see any radical changes coming quickly. I mean...
Now, do you mean, when you say radical changes, do you mean in that no new, qualitatively new phenomena will be found?
Yeah, I mean,
as opposed to astrophysical understanding.
Yes. I mean, clearly, what we need now is decent high resolution maps of the compact objects, which requires synthesis on a global scale. Now that's going to be an awfully long and hard problem.
Yeah.
To do, and already we know roughly what these things are. I mean, there are bits flying out from the center, and you can see something of what's going on in there. But my guess is that it'll be more than 10 years before we really know an awful lot more about this. And then what use, you could say, what use is that without the optical data to go with it?
Yeah.
I mean, the resolution of this far exceeds any optical picture now.
Yeah, right.
And if in radio on its own,
is a bit of a weak tool. I mean, it's when you combine it with optical spectroscopy and all the rest of it that you really begin to find out what's going on.
Well, in fact, I was going to suggest that you might say that something like the LST would really be more likely to come up with some real fundamental discoveries.
I would say so,
discoveries.
Yes. I think to achieve the optical resolution is
hundreds of an arc second, the optical would be an entirely new thing.
I think we've got to wait for the optical astronomy to catch up with the techniques, and produce maps of comparable resolution. Yeah, I think that's probably right. But there aren't many bits of the spectrum unexplored. And, I mean, there's millimeters. There's some new phenomena in millimeters, but that's...
But, for instance, the whole infrared spectrum has not been looked at in any detail. Infrared spectroscopy, for instance, could bust open...
any new spectrum, obviously, can have surprises in there.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
That is an interview with Hewish on 19th August 76.